This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, I'm not Tony Perkins. Sandy Rios with you filling in for Tony. I am the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association. I do the morning show for American Family Radio, kind of starting the day out, and then Tony does the drive time, and I'm always honored to fill in for him. I have to tell you that there is some really bad news out of New York City. Many are calling it a terrorist attack. The police and the FBI, of course, are very slow to say that. But what's happened is that someone who appeared to be in a truck that had Home Depot on the side, appeared to be a rental truck, made his way down a bike path intentionally, hitting people walking, riding their bikes, then jumped out of the truck. Now, this is what I'm hearing. You'll see it confirmed. This is what we know so far. It looks as though he jumped out of the truck and began shooting, had two different guns. Six people at least are dead. I've heard anywhere from 9 to 15 injured, but of course it's in process. They said he was yelling when he got out of the truck. What he was yelling, we don't know. But witnesses to the event say it was a terrorist attack, but others are the police, as I said, and the FBI. Of course, they never say that. They never say that. They certainly never said it at Fort Hood, and it makes us not trust them. And so it was outside of a high school on this Stuyvesant High School in Lower Manhattan. It happened at 3:30, just when the kids were coming out of school. May or may not be related to that. Some are saying that the man driving the vehicle did try to hit a school bus. I don't know if he hit it or not. They said there weren't children on the bus. There were adults on the bus. So that's the update. It took place in New York City just hour and a half ago, hour and 35 minutes ago. And so our first guest today, ironically, is Andy McCarthy. Andy is a New Yorker down to his bones and was the prosecutor of the first World Trade Center bombing. When it comes to terrorism and potential terrorism, nobody knows more about this, really, than Andy. And this is his hometown. And so, Andy, first of all, I just want to say hi. And how are you in New York City right now?
I am not. I'm outside the city.
Okay. But you have kids and, you know, I know your heart, Andy. You just must be gripping to see what's happening right now.
Sandy, I hate to tell you this, but you're telling me something I don't know about because I've been in back-to-back meetings until we spoke.
You know what? I just set it up, and I thought maybe you were listening. I understand totally. Let me just tell you that a man in a rental truck with the label Home Depot has plowed down people on a bike path. At least six are dead, 15 or 9 to 15 injured. He yelled, got out of the car. We don't know what he yelled. He pulled out two guns and started shooting people. Eyewitnesses say it was consistent with a terror attack. It happened just outside the Stuyvesant High School in Lower Manhattan. It happened at 3:30, just when the kids were getting out of school. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you that, Andy, because I know it's more than just writing to you. This is something you live through in New York City.
Well, it's horrific. What we're surprised, those of us who watch this side of the street, so to speak, is that this doesn't happen more often. You know, Sandy, when I got involved in counterterrorism, it sounds ironic and oddball to say this, but we were very lucky that the jihadists were essentially interested in big sensational attacks, because as we saw in 9/11, while those are horrific when they happen, they're really tough to pull off, and you're apt to be able to stop them because it takes so long to plan them and there's so much coordination involved. What's really disturbing about the modern jihadist threat, and I know we don't know where this attack comes from yet and the nature of it, but it sure sounds familiar, and it's certainly reasonable to think along these lines, is that that threat of sensational attack has not gone away. It still exists. But now the jihadists are apt to take what we basically call the low-hanging fruit. You know, all the stuff where we used to wonder, you know, why don't they do something in the subway, and why don't they just shoot up people on the street? And why not? Now they're starting to do that kind of thing. If this is another one of these auto or vehicular jihadist attacks, There's now been, I would imagine, there's been at least a score of them. I mean, if you include the Israeli experience, it was happening there with some regularity long before it spread to Western Europe and spread to the United States. So it's really a very disturbing development, if that's what it is.
You know, and I do want to get to the topic we're planning to discuss, but I just have to say one more time. You know, one of the things that's so discouraging about this, Andy, is the FBI and the police are rushing to say it's not a terrorist attack. Witnesses are saying that they think it most definitely was. And the sad thing to me is we don't trust our FBI. We don't trust our police. Not the powers that be that make these pronouncements. We have lost trust. You know, I was in Turkey, Istanbul, in the airport when the Fort Hood shooting took place. I nearly came out of my chair when I heard them downplaying it and calling it workplace violence. It was just unforgivable, unbelievable. And now this has become the pattern of law enforcement. So how in the world are we to know what's true and what isn't?
Yeah, you know, the two problems with this, Sandy, is, you know, number one, if you don't acknowledge the enemy and call it what it is and try to understand it, then you're not ever going to be able to protect yourself from it. Because you don't know what you're looking for, and you have to do sort of proactive, as they say, intelligence in order to prevent this kind of stuff. So you have to acknowledge what it is, otherwise you can't even do an intelligence product. But the other thing that is unseen but very important is when we're reticent, when we're really reluctant about mentioning or naming what we're up to and calling an obvious terrorist attack a terrorist attack, it's emboldening to the people who are carrying out the terrorist attack. It makes them think that, you know, we don't have the stomach to acknowledge it and to fight them, which just encourages them to do more attacks. So I just think it's a really counterproductive mindset, and it's a really counterproductive way to go about counterterrorism.
All right, Andy, speaking of terrorism, I have to say that I know FBI agents that served under former director, FBI Director Bob Mueller, and I've heard them say they wish that he had gone after terrorists with the same enthusiasm he's going after President Donald Trump and some link to the Russians, which brings us to our conversation. Bob Mueller brought down an indictment against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates just Monday, did a house search without announcement to Paul Manafort's house. And has brought this indictment on several counts and seems determined to make a link between the Trump campaign and Russia. But you don't think there's much there, according to what you have written. Just say a word about that, please. Why not?
Well, look, there's two. I think in a nutshell, Sandy, there were two sets of charges that came out yesterday, right? There was the Manafort indictment, and then there was the one count that was pled guilty to by a fellow by the name of George Papadopoulos, right? So if we start with Manafort, which is the one that everybody kind of anticipated, what's striking about that case is that while it's certainly a matter of great concern to Manafort personally, the reason I called it Much Ado About Nothing is it's got utterly nothing to do with the thing that is the mandate for Mueller's investigation, which is to investigate Russian meddling in the election and what, if any, connection did the Trump campaign have to it. So, you know, that's what we've been hearing about for over a year. We've heard that Manafort's the main guy, right? We get to the day he finally gets charged, and there's nothing in there about collusion with Russia. And then you go over to this guy Papadopoulos. That was the surprise of yesterday, because he's Mueller's big insider who's now pled guilty, right? And when you read his case actually does have something to do with collusion. In fact, if you read the 14-page description of the offense, there's collusion coming out the ears. There's collusion on every page. You know, they're talking about meetings between Trump and Putin they're trying to arrange, low-level meetings between Trump campaign people and Kremlin people. He's meeting with someone at the foreign ministry. He thinks he's meeting with Putin's niece, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all kinds of collusion. This guy pleads guilty. Now, for any prosecutor, what you want in your case is an accomplice witness to come in and say, I'm guilty, I plead guilty, I did it. There really is a scheme here. here's who I did it with, here's how we did it, et cetera. So Mueller gets just as kind of an insider, and what does he have him plead guilty to? Does he have him plead guilty to the collusion scheme? No. He pleads guilty to one count of making a false statement, a process crime, making a false statement to an FBI agent that he's looking basically at no jail time for. Now, why does he do that? He does it because collusion is not a crime. And the thing that we've been that I've been trying to hammer home to people for over a year is that prosecutors don't care about collusion. You and I are colluding by having this conversation. Collusion is just concerted activity, and while it sounds sinister, it actually can be perfectly legal. What prosecutors care about is conspiracy, and a conspiracy is an agreement to violate a particular federal law. And what I think what yesterday shows, and particularly the Papadopoulos case shows, is they don't have that, and they're not going to get it, because what they need to show is that Russia violated some law and the Trump people were complicit in that violation. So, you know, the Trump people were involved in the hacking of computer systems or something. The Papadopoulos case, to the contrary, seems to show that can't be true, because if you believe what Mueller has put out, that is, if you believe what these people were telling, these Russians were telling Papadopoulos, they were telling him they had scads of Hillary Clinton emails that they might want to share. Not only is there no evidence that the sharing of those actually happened, but if the Russians had to tell the Trump campaign that they had these emails, that means the Trump campaign didn't have anything to do with the Russians acquiring the emails, which is what the hacking's all about.
Which is what the investigation's supposed to be all about.
Right.
But Paul Manafort is still in trouble. I mean, isn't he? I was reading that he and Gates face decades of prison, millions of fines, that the judges who are assigned to hear this case are both Obama appointees who have given to the Clinton campaigns. It seems to me the fix is in for Paul Manafort.
Well, look, he's in big trouble. And from what I understand about his background and what I see in this indictment, he probably deserves to be in big trouble. But to say that he deserves to be in big trouble doesn't mean that there was a collusion scheme with Russia. And I do believe that what's going on here is that indictment, since it doesn't have anything to do with collusion, is a vehicle to squeeze him for cooperation. But here's the problem, Sandy. You know me, right? We've known each other for a long time now. They could ask you, you know, they could try to flip you as a witness against me for the robbery of the First National Bank. But if I didn't rob the First National Bank, what are you going to tell them? It does, you know, I mean, they can squeeze you and they can do all kinds of stuff to you. But if you didn't actually do the thing they're investigating, where does it get them?
Yeah, not very far. Gosh, Andy, we could talk so much longer, as always. But listen, thank you, as always, for your time. I know you're everywhere today trying to make clear what you're seeing here. National Review article. National Review has Andy's article on this. Not Much There and A Boon for Trump is the title. Plus, he's written about Papadopoulos, which will fill in the blanks on that. Andy McCarthy, prosecutor of the blind shake, also the author of Willful Blindness, responsible for much of our understanding about what jihad really is. Andy, thank you so much for joining us. Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch.
We've gone from give me liberty or give me death to take care of me, please. What has happened to the American spirit? Our colleges were once bastions of free speech. Now they're bastions of speech codes. Our culture once rewarded independence. Now it rewards victimhood. Parents once taught their kids how to fend for themselves. Now any parent who tries may get a visit from the police. In a talk about his new book, Not a Daycare, Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, takes a hard look at what's happening around the country, including demands for safe spaces and trigger warnings at universities like Yale, Brandeis, and Oberlin, and digs in his heels against the sad and dangerous dumbing down of the American spirit. Dr. Piper has become known for his passionate defense of intellectual freedom, and he challenges the intolerant tolerance of today's academic community. Go to frc.org/speakers to watch. Again, that's frc.org/speakers. In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Sandy Reels back with you and happy to be filling in for Tony Perkins. And by the way, you can follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, at T Perkins. Of course, the Family Research Council is just a great repository for great information, and I'm sure all of you know that. That's why you listen. And Tony is a real champion in Washington, and we're proud to have him on AFR Radio, American Family Radio, and that's what I do the morning show for them, and also am the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association. I want to mention, let me mention that there was a terrible attack in New York City at 3:30 this afternoon Eastern Standard Time. A man in a rental truck plowed down a bike path and then began shooting, was yelling. Witnesses say it was a terrorist attack. Police and FBI are not saying that yet. 6 dead, maybe somewhere between 9 and 15 injured. And, of course, that number is and counting. I know this is Halloween. But I have to say, I'm not a real fan of Halloween. Now, I used to be. When I was a kid, I loved Halloween, loved it. It was a much more innocent time. But I have to say that since I've grown up and since I have really seen raw evil, as I think maybe you have too, what we are fighting in this country and really across the globe is unadulterated evil. And we're seeing its face more and more clearly all the time. And that's why I have a hard time finding it funny or amusing to talk about goblins and demons and witches. It's just not funny to me anymore. And I would have to say, if you ask me, I would say, I think it's maybe a good idea to steer your children in a different direction. And you know what? There's a great direction to steer them. It's wonderful. And that is, you know what today is? Today is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. It is the day, October the 31st of 1517, Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses on the Wittenberg church door. Now, what does that mean? It means a lot, really. It means so much to you and to me, especially those of us that are Christ followers. Not everyone listening is, but a lot of you are. And if you kind of need to understand the importance of that event, it was brought about because the Catholic Church at that time had become so corrupt. There had been three popes, not one, but three. They were living with various women. There was complete and utter immorality in the Catholic leadership. And add to that, they were beginning to sell salvation. Like you could be right with God if you just pay the right amount of money. And they were using that money to build St. Peter's in Rome. And that's the bottom line. Pope Leo, that's what he was doing. And they would say, how could you not give money when your grandmother is in hell burning? And, you know, if you love her, you'll give this money and you can get her out of hell. That's basically what these indulgences were. Well, Martin Luther was just a poor monk, an Augustinian monk. And he just thought, this can't be right. This is not right. And he had actually been so tormented by his lack of, he was just aware of his sin. He would confess sometimes as many as 7 hours a day. He felt so guilty for everything that he had done because he had been studying the scriptures. In fact, his mentor suggested maybe he should teach the Bible just to stop confessing. He said to Luther, stop confessing these just ordinary sins. Do something. He said, maybe you should teach the Bible. So Luther did. And in the course of actually studying, he came across the passage in Romans, which said that what happens is that God gives us righteousness. We can never obtain it. We can never stop sinning. We can never change our nature on our own. God gives us his righteousness, and Jesus paid the price. And that does, of course, mean to Luther, it doesn't mean to you that means you can do whatever you want. It means that you recognize what a great price was paid, and then you do what's right before God because you love him, not because you're scared that he's going to punish you. So that was what the Reformation was all about, and that was just the beginning. Martin Luther then was thought that he was going to be killed because many of his friends had been killed. John Huss had been murdered 100 years before, burned to death, actually, for saying many of the same things that Martin Luther was saying. And Luther thought for sure that he was going to be killed. When he went before the council, they gave him 24 hours, and he came before them the next day, and he said, here I stand. I can do no more. It's only scripture. It's only God. My conscience is clear. And so he thought they were going to kill him, but they didn't because he was so popular with the people. So as he was leaving, the powers that be said they're going to let him leave and going to let him live, but anyone that wanted to kill him could feel free to do that. So as Luther's riding his horse, leaving, five men come and kidnap him and take him to Wittenberg Castle. It turns out that these five men were friends. They were guards of the Elector Frederick, who was kind of a mentor to Martin Luther. They hid him in the Wittenberg Castle, and he stayed there for months. But in the course of those months, Martin Luther did something that really would change the world. Many things, too huge. He translated the Latin Vulgate, which was the Latin scriptures, the Bible in Latin, which only the priests, only the hierarchy could read. The people didn't understand the services. They only sang Gregorian chant in Latin. The monks sang. The people didn't sing. Martin Luther translated the Bible into German. He created the German Bible in absolutely record time, the entire Bible, Old and New Testament. He also began to write songs. He wrote, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. And when Luther got out of prison, because the Gutenberg Press had been invented, his writings, his hymns, everything began to go all over Germany and then finally all over the world. And so as a result of that, people discovered personal faith. They didn't have to go through the priest. They could read the Bible for themselves. They could sing hymns and worship actively in church. And the Reformation movement spread all over the world. It spread to Scotland. It spread to Geneva, Switzerland. It created the foundation that gave us the Pilgrims and the Moravians, who in the wave of the Reformation came to this country and founded it and came to us with such a great passion. It probably is the reason we have the Mayflower Compact, so beautifully written when the Pilgrims landed on these shores. So this is the day when we celebrate Halloween, All Hallows Eve. It was All Hallows Eve in 1517 when Martin Luther pounded those 95 theses, just the truth, and took such a great risk, even risking his life. This is what we should be celebrating today, not goblins and demons and witches. I would just encourage you to do that with your family and your friends. All right, Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Be right back right after this.
Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Sandy Rios back with you, filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. And by the way, if you'd like to follow me, I'm at Sandy Rios Tweet, at Sandy Rios Tweet. Tony Perkins is out doing something important, I'm sure of it. And so it's my pleasure and honor to fill in for him today. Let me just update you. It looks at though eight are dead, at least eight are dead in that what might have been a terrorist attack in New York City at 3:30 this afternoon Eastern Standard Time. So the death count is rising. And, you know, I was just talking about the Reformation. I want to give you just a practical tip. If you would like more information, because really this is something you should know about, isn't it? And it's exciting. It's our history. Church history is really thrilling. So is American history. And we can't let it die. It really is the thread that binds us and enthuses us and gives us a foundation. You know, it's kind of like being an orphan. And kids that are orphaned or adopted often love to see who their families of origin are because they can see what they look like. They have traits that are similar. And so it is with our history. When we're untethered with our history, we don't really know who we are. And it's kind of exciting to reconnect and the reason how it is that we got here. Let me just tell you that Dr. Erwin Lutzer, the pastor emeritus of Moody Church in Chicago, wrote a book just this year called Rescuing the Gospel. Rescuing the Gospel, which I highly recommend. It's not a long book, but it tells the story of the Reformation as only Dr. Lutzer can tell it. So I'm recommending that tool to you. Next Tuesday is a big election in Virginia, and why should we care? Because a lot of the races in Virginia have repercussions for the whole country. You know, Virginia is it's a satellite, really. Some of you in Southern Virginia might not like me saying this, but it's kind of a satellite to D.C. and all that happens there. Northern Virginia certainly is. And so a lot of the resources of the left and the right are thrown into some races, and there are some going on that have national implications. One just came out yesterday, or in the last couple of days. It's running against Ed Gillespie, who's the Republican candidate. That it's just pretty appalling. Tucker Carlson talked about it last night. I want you to listen to this.
Well, a new ad by the Latino Victory Fund in the Virginia governor's race portrays supporters of Republican Ed Gillespie as violent racists who want to murder kids. Think we're overstating? Watch this. Emily Tish Sussman is the campaign director for the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and she joins us today. Emily, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I watched this ad. I've seen a lot of tough political ads, you know, over decades of watching it, and I thought, you know, they're actually just pushing race war here. That's what this is. This is the most single most disgusting, unfair thing I've ever seen. I'm not any great Ed Gillespie partisan at all. But, like, I don't see any justification for running something like that.
Well, I think the justification is the fact that it's really just putting a mirror up to the campaign that Gillespie has running. I think a lot of Republicans, I know a lot of Republicans, are really disgusted with the campaign that he's been running. It's a lot of race baiting.
Give me one example of Ed Gillespie's race baiting.
By putting the Confederate statues at the center of his campaign, by running ads that imply that most people that are immigrants are related to MS-13 or defending MS-13.
Well, he hasn't said that most people relate who are immigrants are connected to MS-13. I've watched it really carefully. I mean, by the way, Ed Gillespie is on the liberal scale on immigration, to put it mildly. I mean, I'm not attacking him, just saying, like, he's nowhere near Donald Trump on immigration, or me for that matter. Where has he said most immigrants sympathize with MS-13? I've heard him say point blank, MS-13 preys upon immigrants.
Look, the ads that he is running are race baiting because they are making people fearful. They're bringing out the worst in people. They're trying to drive people to the polls.
All right, that's Emily Tish Sussman. She is with Center for American Progress. And here's the thing. The ad shows a white gentleman in a big pickup truck with a Don't Tread on Me license plate and an Ed Gillespie sticker. And the truck is trying to run down these kids. They're Hispanic, they're Muslim, and they're screaming, yelling for their lives. You get the picture. And so the truck, again, Don't Tread on Me and an Ed Gillespie sticker. It really is appalling, honestly. It's called an American nightmare, which it is, but not in the way they mean. It's a nightmare to have them divide and scare people with such outrageous lies. And as Tucker said, Ed Gillespie, for me, is not on the right side in terms of immigration from my perspective. I would take a much harder stand. I actually think we should have a wall. I actually think we should enforce our laws. I actually think we need to take care of our own children. And then with what we have left over, take in the world's children. That's what I think. Ed is not so strict on that, but they're attacking him as though he is. So he wants to kill immigrant children. It's being paid for by a group called Latino Victory Fund. And if you follow the funding of Latino Victory Fund, surprise, surprise, it is they get lots of money from George Soros, the Hungarian American. He's Hungarian born. He's an American citizen, billionaire, who has devoted his life and his resources to destroying the country as we know it. And so his finger is on almost every leftist, socialist, I'll just say it, communist cause in the country. Anything that will destroy the country, usually he has his label on it. Maybe you don't see his label. But his hands, if you follow the money, that's where it goes. So Latino Victory Fund is created that ad with the help of George Soros money. It's really pretty stunning. Also in that in Virginia is a race between a transgender candidate, Danica Rome, and a Delegate Bob Marshall. Boy, what a contrast. So you have a transgender candidate and you have Bob Marshall, who is the staunchest pro-life, pro-family delegate in Virginia. So he's being targeted with thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to try to defeat him. All of that happening this Tuesday. Coming up next, Matt Staver is going to talk to me about the judge that tried to throw out the president's orders on transgenders in the military. We'll be right back. Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins.
Are you worried about the moral direction of America? Do you feel powerless to make a difference? Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. Established in 1983 in Washington, D.C., Family Research Council conducts research, develops policy, drafts legislation, and educates policymakers, pastors, and the grassroots. It testifies before Congress and shapes public debate through the media and internet. Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about Family Research Council, please visit us at frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news. Again, that's frc.org.
In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Sandy Rios back, filling in for Tony Perkins. That's a good bumper for a day like this. Now they are saying that that attack in New York City at 3:30 this afternoon was in fact an act of terror, even though Mayor said that. So if Mayor de Blasio said it must be, the reports are that the shooter, the assaulter in a rental truck and then using guns shouted Allahu Akbar, killed at the last count we had is at least eight and many more injured. I don't know the numbers, and I'm sure they're still counting. I just saw that Josh Groban was very close to the scene. He said he was planning on being on that corner, but his dog kind of pulled him away, so he's pretty shaken. It was near a school in Lower Manhattan, so you can imagine the kids had just gotten out of school. So you can imagine. You can just imagine. And so here we are again. Has there ever been a time when people needed to acknowledge God more and be on their knees? We always need to do that, but these kinds of things bring us a sobriety that I think God can use. Oh, don't misunderstand me. I don't think God doesn't want to have to do this or allow it to get our attention. That's not what I'm saying, but he doesn't waste it. I think there's a lot of wickedness, and that's why I say this, you know, when you let your, I don't know. So kids are going to dress up in bloody horror costumes tonight and walk around. That bothers me. I just feel like the wickedness, the evil, the vampire movies that our kids are seeing, the themes of death, zombies, it's amazing what's happened to us that we should become so dulled to the wickedness of it all. I'm not saying some of it can't be innocent. When I was a kid, it certainly was. I actually, to tell you the truth, belonged and formed with my buddy who was 2 years older than I. This guy, we were good friends, and we formed the Bloody Hand Society, and it was our job to go see every horror movie that came out. But, of course, it was much more innocent then. It was, it wasn't Friday the 13th. It wasn't bloody. It was more imagination. It was like Martians and those kinds of things. So there can be, maybe, an innocence, but I think the innocence left the building a long time ago. So I'm just challenging you parents to think about it differently and maybe weave in that this is a great day, Reformation Day, 500 years. There are a lot of things to teach your kids about that and a lot of things to celebrate. All right, I've said enough about that. Something really big happened this week. Let's let Reuters tell us, and then I'll introduce our next guest.
President Trump's move to ban transgender people from serving in the military blocked in court Monday after a federal judge ruled that Trump's directive cannot be enforced. Reuters legal correspondent Andrew Chung explains why.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C. issued a preliminary injunction blocking the Trump administration's actions on banning transgender people in the military. It's preliminary because what the judge said is that the plaintiffs in the case, which are a number of transgender service members, are likely to succeed on their claims that the policies are unconstitutional. And so the federal judge issued this preliminary injunction to stop the policy from going ahead while the case goes on through the court.
The ruling is a loss for Trump and a win for transgender service members who accused the president of violating their rights to due process and equal protection under the Constitution. Trump's directive appealed to his hardline conservative supporters and would have reversed efforts by former President Obama to eliminate barriers to military service based on sexual orientation or gender identity. In February, Trump also rescinded protections put in place under Obama for transgender public school students.
All right, so that's a report from Reuters, and that's the beginning of it. Matt Staver joins us now. Of course, he's the president and founder of Liberty Council. Matt has been around the block a bit on this topic, and Matt, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
You know, I guess everybody wants to know, Matt, how could a U.S. district judge overrule a presidential order when he's the commander-in-chief, and this has to do with military, not any kind of, it's the military. So how can a U.S. district judge have any kind of say whatsoever?
Well, that's a good question. This, of course, the military, the commander-in-chief has lots of authority and autonomy over who serves and the criteria for service. Obviously, the commander-in-chief is the number one person over the military, not judges. And so this particular decision by this judge is very disturbing. It's disturbing for several reasons because, number one, it intrudes the courts into this sacrosanct area of the military, tells the commander-in-chief who can be admitted into the military, despite the fact that the commander-in-chief has said, no, this is not in the best interest of our troops for military readiness and unit cohesion. But what this judge also did that's more disturbing is essentially say that the issue of transgenderism should receive some elevated scrutiny, not the highest level of scrutiny like race, but not the lowest level of scrutiny either, something in between. And therefore, because of that heightened scrutiny, said that the executive branch didn't prove its case and that the so-called transgender military people did. And it looks like this judge says, on the merits, they might ultimately succeed. And so consequently, put a temporary block. It's not a permanent block, but as we speak right now, President Trump's directive is not enforceable under this particular court order, except the provision about not paying for so-called sex reassignment surgeries. The judge said there was not enough evidence by the plaintiffs to show that they were harmed by that. So that's the only provision, that the military, federal taxpayer dollars, will not pay for the hormone treatments and the invasive plastic surgery. But on the other hand, it means also that the military is going to be wide open for these so-called transgender people who are confused about who they really are.
Oh, the Justice Department's fighting back, and they're saying they disagree with the court's ruling. They're evaluating the next steps. They think it's too soon for this decision from a court, as though they had the right anyway, because the Trump administration had delivered, okay, this started with a tweet from President Trump rescinding President Obama's orders through Carter, what was his name? His defense secretary.
Well, the defense secretary, sure, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think they're right about this because it did start with a tweet, but President Trump indicated, however, that he had consulted with his other military directors. And then he followed that up by saying that the military was directed to implement the policy. So they're in the process of looking at the parameters, how far this is going, what's going to happen to the people who already have been admitted under the flawed Obama policy that he pushed through last year just before he left office. And then obviously for future, to not allow any future openings for people who are openly transgender because it involves confusion, it involves conflict, it involves moving the focus from military readiness onto somebody's identity and who they are, and those kinds of issues
showers and locker rooms and bunking rooms and all that, something that military shouldn't have to deal with. So it is premature, frankly, and the government has a good argument. This court should never have entertained this decision. The court should have said to the plaintiffs, look, this case is still ongoing. The final regulations of how this is going to happen, and especially how it's going to affect you, the plaintiffs, who are currently serving in the military, has not yet been completely fleshed out. We're going to have to come back for another day once the administration completes its procedures. But no, what the judge did is jump ahead and put this temporary injunction in place.
Matt, it's the same question I asked before, though. I just don't understand. You know, the same thing happened on the immigration or allowing people into the country.
Right.
When the president was just elected and he wrote an executive order that said that people from predominantly Muslim countries would be banned until there was a better vetting. And so then the courts, you know, from what, Hawaii, Washington State, wherever, they jumped in. This whole precedent of being able to stop the president from doing anything that he rightfully can do as commander in chief by a district court in some other state way far away. Is there a precedent for such court action?
Well, you know, here's what's happening, Sandy, and I think you've touched on something that's a very serious concern of all of us, and that is the judiciary that has gotten out of control. And now what we have are individual judges, single judges, in the chambers behind closed doors, writing an opinion and wanting to direct the president to follow it. Now, the president has a choice. The president can appeal this, and certainly the president will. The president will continue to litigate it. But the president also has a choice. And this is a choice that Thomas Jefferson used. And maybe it's time for this to happen in certain select situations. And that is, these court decisions have no authority unless the executive chooses to enforce them. It's a voluntary decision. Now, I know we've been like Pavlov's dogs. Whenever a court makes a decision, the executive all of a sudden just falls in line. But that's not how it's been historically. That's not what Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln did. They ultimately challenge sometimes these court decisions and refuse to just go along with unconstitutional decisions. You know, here we have military and military readiness at issue, the highest level of our national security. And the president ought to be able to have a substantial say in how that military is directed. The people have elected a commander-in-chief, a president, but also in that role, a commander-in-chief. So judges should not be micromanaging, and that's what they're doing, micromanaging and dictating who is eligible to serve in the military. That's never been the role of a judge and should never be the role of a judge.
Well, I agree, and I want to read to you something that you've probably seen, but there were training manuals prepared under the Obama administration. Ash Carter, before he left office, Ash Carter made this decision, and the president, of course, joined in. Of course, I'm sure the president was all about this because we know for sure there was no LGBT action he ever did not embrace enthusiastically. And so this is from the training manual. I'm reading from the Breitbart article. The transgender ideology focuses forces female soldiers to give dignity and respect, that's in quotes, to transsexual men who join them in their shared shower rooms. And according to Obama-era training manuals leaked by soldiers in a mandatory class, the dignity and respect, though, is a one-way street. According to the training slides, which were developed by officials working for former President Barack Obama, transgender soldiers are not required or expected to modify or adjust their behavior based on the fact that they do not match other soldiers. That's a direct quote from the slides.
Right. So here you have women that are in the showers, for example. And here's a man that now wants to, because of confusion, be with the women, identify as a woman, be thought of as a woman. So that man still has male genitalia, walks into the shower room completely naked. These women have to accept it. If they object, they will be punished. They will be disciplined for discrimination against this so-called transgender. So it's a one-way street. Here you have, and we're talking about anywhere in the world, whether they're in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, no matter where they are, these people have to put up with this kind of nonsense and invasion of privacy and assault, frankly, on their common decency and sense. We should not put our men and women in the military in that kind of situation. The military is not a social experimentation, LGBT propaganda machine, as President Obama tried to turn it into. President Trump has done the right thing, reversing that policy, going back to the way it's historically been from George Washington on to the president. And the judge should not be interfering with that. That's a dangerous step indeed that ultimately, I think, destabilizes our military and hurts our men and women in armed services.
Matt, what happens next? What do you think we're going to see happen next?
Well, I know what will happen next in part, and I know that certainly the Trump administration will no doubt appeal this case. It's not over. This is a preliminary, but it's a big setback, no question about it. I think also it may be coming time to revisit how much authority do these judges really have. I don't think they have the authority that they think they do, and they only have the authority that the executive gives them. And it may be time for that to be challenged. I know that would be controversial, but that's just right what Jefferson did, and it's certainly what Abraham Lincoln did. He refused to just simply bow down to Chief Justice Taney when he issued an order. You know, the executive is the enforcer branch, and if the executive doesn't enforce the federal opinion, that's all it is an opinion. On the other hand, I think that they'll continue to do some more investigation and study. I think they'll come up with some additional evidence as they move forward. But by and large, I hope that this thing goes expeditiously. I hope the Court of Appeals quickly reverses the situation and puts it back to the way Trump did it. And I think that that's the way it ultimately has to be. You know, the military is not open for everyone. No one has the right to serve in the military. It's not a constitutional right to be in the military. It is a privilege, and not everyone is able to do it. There are certain kinds of things that disqualify you, from vision to physical situations to mental to a wide range of situations that disqualify individuals. And certainly this should not be a place where it is a social transformation and an LGBT indoctrination facility. This is a lethal weapon. And we need to give our men and women the best possible environment where there's no distractions and no confusion.
You know, that reminds me of an interview I just did this morning on my own show. There is a gentleman who's a Navy SEAL, former Navy SEAL, 10 years, who was running for a delegate in Virginia. And he told me that in one class of Navy SEALs, there were 200 students. And at the end of the class, not a single person passed. Not a single person became a Navy SEAL. He said in his own class, there were 200 candidates and only 17 graduated. My point is your point, Matt, is that no matter what, not everybody qualifies. Not everybody can just because they want to. Not everybody can be a woman just because they want to. And not everyone can be a man just because they want to. There are some things that are limited by God, by nature, and nature's God. So Matt Staver, Liberty Counsel, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your expertise today. Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. This has been Washington Watch, Family Research Council, FRC.org. It's at T. Perkins. If you want to follow Tony on Twitter, you can follow me at Sandy Rios Tweet. I'm on at 8 o'clock in the morning on AFR Talk. Thank you so much for listening.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.